Okay. Well, without further ado, we've had enough announcements and all that stuff. Let's get right to the main event. I'm going to ask good friend Kelly to come up and introduce our speaker.
Kelly Haddock. I wasn't expecting this. So I get to introduce Charles. You know, I've been clean long enough that they didn't used to do this, right? You'd have a speaker and that would just be the speaker. And then somewhere along the decades, there was an introductor. And I remember talking shit about that. And now, like, I get to introduce, right? So you can see, if you're sitting there talking shit, like, yeah, I get you, right? We'll go have coffee together. Back in July, I was looking to move to Vegas. And I've known Charles from Boxes. And so I reached out and I said, hey, yeah, I think I'm going to come out. He goes, well, you need to come to my home group. It's Saturday night in Henderson, Unloaded. So I went out there, I went out to the meeting, and I walked in, and for the first time, I felt like finally I found a home. It's been a long time. So that became my home group. He came over I moved there in September. We're having. He came over for a football game, I think, and he's sitting there, and he says, "Yeah, I'm speaking in Alabama." And I said, "In February?" "Yeah, in Decatur." And I went, "You mean Decatur? You're speaking in Decatur, Alabama? Do they know you?" So, what I can say is this, and I'll shut up. Alabama, I don't know if you're ready for Charles. But I know for a fact Charles is ready for you. Come on.
I'm an addict. My name is Charles. Ooh, look at you. Sitting here clean. I know that Decatur, Alabama is grateful that you are in here clean instead of out there using because of all the crimes that are not being committed tonight. Right? Even addicts said it couldn't be done the way we had it planned. They said it couldn't be done. We believed in openly scheduled meetings, no more hiding as other groups had tried before, that this, what's going on right now, was principally needed in our lives. Right? So look, if you're sitting here tonight and you can, and if you're new to our fellowship, if you've been here for a while, I want to let you know that you are sitting here and you are about to witness history being made. History is being made right now. Because for the first time in man's entire history, a simple way is proving itself in the lives of many addicts. And here's the best part, it's available to us all. This is a simple, spiritual, not religious program known as Narcotics Anonymous. This is my first time in Alabama. But I've wanted to be here for a long time. Every year, in December and January, I would sit at home and I'd watch the TV, and I just wanted to be in Alabama. I would say it from my house, in Las Vegas, but I never got to come to Alabama and fucking say Roll Tide.
Yeah.
Shut the fuck up. Look, man, I want to welcome anybody who's new to this fellowship. Right? I want to welcome anybody here who's in their first 30 days clean. Most importantly, I want to welcome anybody who's here in their last 30 days clean. See, the difference between the person in their first 30 days clean and the person in their last 30 days clean is the person who's sitting here in their first 30 days clean, they know they're in their first 30 days clean. See, there's somebody sitting here thinking that they're okay, and in reality, they're in their last 30 days clean. An attitude of indifference or intolerance. An unwillingness to serve. Somebody living in ego. See, sick pride and ego means I'm going to look good even if it kills me. I'm not going to go into a meeting and share what's going on with me because I got sponsees in there. Let me enlighten you. Your sponsees already know how fucked up you are, and they're already talking shit about you behind your back. So you may as well go in and share about it. My clean date is May 18th, 1998. I've been clean for 26 years, 8 months and a few weeks. I've been clean that long. Not sober, clean. My recovery is based in as well as exclusive to Narcotics Anonymous. I haven't felt the need to work any other steps. I haven't felt the need to have a sponsor in any other fellowship. I haven't felt the need to do service in any other fellowship. I pledge allegiance to this fellowship because this was the first thing that I ever pledged 100% allegiance to was Narcotics Anonymous. This is the first thing I've ever been faithful to. Maybe the only thing I've ever been faithful to. Quite possibly. I'm a firm believer in one fellowship. I've been clean, like I said, since May 18th, 1998. I've been clean since I was 17 years old. And I'm not going to share much with you about active addiction. Truth is, there's not much to share. Our literature talks about we need not dwell excessively on our using. And I know a lot of the times we think that the newcomer needs to hear what it was like in active addiction. I don't believe the newcomer needs to hear that. I believe that the newcomer just came from there. Yeah. Doesn't need to hear about it because it's fresh. They already know what it's like in active addiction. Right? So I'm not going to dwell excessively on my using. I'm going to tell you that I heard stuff when I first got here like, oh, I spilled more than you used. And I would think, well, maybe if you had have used more and spilled less, you may have gotten here at the same age I got here if you weren't too busy spilling. Because I didn't spill much, as a matter of fact. I thought that I spilled stuff that I didn't spill, and I'd be on the carpet looking for stuff that was never spilled. So I was sharing one time a few years ago at this convention, and I shared that I got clean at 17, and someone said, so how bad could it have gotten at 17? So, look, I'm not going to share much about using, but this is what I'll share with you. This is what using was like for me. The way that I got around town is, number one, I was pathetic. I wasn't a dope dealer. I never had any money. I was always begging, borrowing, stealing, anything that I could do to live. I lived to use and I used to live. And the way that I got from one side of town to the other was I would hitchhike. That's how. I left home when I was 13 years old and I hitchhiked. That's the way that I got around town. And that's essentially using in a nutshell for me. A bunch of hitchhiking, right? And it doesn't sound too bad. Unless you know what happens to 13-year-old boys who jump in the cars with strange men. It doesn't sound so bad unless you know who picks up 13, 14, 15-year-old boys. Sometimes it was as simple as somebody rubbing their hand up my thigh, and sometimes it was a brutal and violent sexual assault. with my head being smashed up against the passenger side door and somebody's forearm on my neck. And maybe me screaming or maybe me just zoning off and pretending like it wasn't happening. And that is the way I lived. 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 years old. So I did not get here. I got here young, but I did not get here early. And so if you are new and you're young, you didn't get here early. You got here right when you were supposed to. You got here the day before you died. And so I was arrested many times. I was in treatment several times, and I heard of the other fellowship, but I never heard of Narcotics Anonymous, and this guy gave me this blue book, and it was the basic text of Narcotics Anonymous, and when I heard the name Narcotics Anonymous, that made sense to me. It's kind of like it spoke to me. It's kind of like, you know, the show where there's this sword and everybody's looking around going, who's the master of the sword? And the guy doesn't find the sword, but the sword finds the guy. And when they find each other, they recognize each other. That was what it was like for me in Narcotics Anonymous. It was like I didn't find Narcotics Anonymous. I listen to people share that. When I found Narcotics Anonymous, I think that you're really fortunate to have found Narcotics Anonymous. I did not find Narcotics Anonymous. Narcotics Anonymous found me. Oh, but when it found me, I recognized Narcotics Anonymous, and Narcotics Anonymous recognized me. When I heard the name Narcotics Anonymous, I didn't know why, but I knew that it was someplace that I needed to be. Nobody explained to me what it was, but for some reason, it just made sense to me. And when I walked into my very first meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, there was a woman sitting in there. Her name was Elena, and she stood up, and she was the greeter. We got any greeters in here? Anybody hold the service commitment of greeter in your home group ever? But she was the greeter. And when she hugged me, it was like she held me. And she was like saying, we've been waiting for you this whole time. Sometimes a loving hug can make all the difference in the world when we are feeling pain. And then I sat down at that first meeting, and where people were sharing, it was like they were sharing the thoughts that I'd always been thinking and they were sharing the feelings that I'd always been feeling, but I was never quite able to verbalize. They put them into words. Before that, if a spaceship had come from the sky and said, Charles, come with us, I would have said, oh, well, that makes complete and total sense, because I knew I didn't belong here. Because I never found any place where I fit in, where I heard people talk about the way that I feel. I never heard anybody who hadn't met me like describe the way that I felt. And I tried everything. I spoke in tongues when I was a kid. I chanted Namno Horenge Kyo for a little bit. My parents had me get acupuncture. Like, I tried all this stuff. And when I walked into my first meeting of Narcotics Anonymous and I sat down and I listened to you share, I found a home. And I knew I belonged here. There was no question. I fell in love with Narcotics Anonymous that first meeting. I fell in love. But this is what I want to share with you about loving Narcotics Anonymous. Loving Narcotics Anonymous will not keep me clean. It's not enough to love Narcotics Anonymous. They gave me some suggestion. Go to a meeting every day. Get a sponsor. Work the step. No. I'm not doing all that. You guys are getting a little too fanatical. Every day, really? Every day? So I went to meetings when I want to, and they said, oh, get a sponsor. And I was like, I got to call this dude. I've heard about people talking about calling their sponsor every day. Yeah, not for me. No thanks. So I just came to meetings mostly every day. You know, you ever heard newcomer, so are you doing that meeting ever? Because the basic text doesn't say 90 and 90. It says a meeting every day for the first night, for at least the first 90 days. So if you want to do the bare minimum, stop at 90 days. Right? And you'll get bare minimum results. You ever heard a newcomer say, I go to meetings most days. Don't say most days. Don't say that. Says a meeting every day for the first 90 days. So I would go to meetings most days, and then I would share and I would impart my words of wisdom on everyone in the meeting. and maybe help somebody save a few lives with all that I knew about, and then I would leave. And Loving Narcotics Anonymous, I used again. If you do what we do, you're going to get what we got. You do something else, you're going to get what you've always gotten. When a newcomer uses, or when somebody's been around here for many years and cannot stay clean, I don't think it's because they don't have the desire to stop using. I think a lot of times it's just because they believe they have a better idea.
Yeah.
Our first tradition calls it the need for self-sufficiency and tells us that it's a lie.
Yeah. Right.
And so I was ready to stop having good ideas. I realized that my ideas were not keeping me clean. So I decided that I was going to start with going to a meeting every day for the first 90 days, for at least the first 90 days. And that's what I did. And you know what happened when I surrendered? I was able to get honest with myself. I was able to admit that one meeting a day wasn't even good enough for me. I was able to admit the fact that I didn't trust myself to be alone, and that if I wasn't hanging out with you, I was going to be hanging out with somebody that I wasn't supposed to be hanging out with. So I went to a meeting at 9:30. I went, when I wasn't working, I went to a meeting at noon. I went to a 2:30 meeting, a 5:30 meeting, a 7 p.m. meeting, and then I went to a 10 p.m. meeting, and then all those freaks who went to the meeting were like, why don't you come out and eat afterwards? And before, I was like, I don't want to hang out with them. Then I was like, but when I really got honest, I was like, please take me with you. Please take me with you. You ever seen the movie The Terminator? It's an old movie, and the Terminator, the guy goes to the woman, he says, come with me if you want to live. When somebody, if you're new, when someone invites you out to eat after the meeting, they're saying, come with me if you want to live. And when we fully concede to our innermost selves, we say, please, where are you going? I don't have any money, but I'll drink coffee. I don't care. I just don't want to be alone because I don't trust me. That's what happens when we're really honest with ourselves. And so I went to a meeting in the morning, went to the 10 p.m. If there was a midnight, I went to that. Then we'd all go to coffee afterwards. And then afterwards, like, we'd all pair off and go have sex with each other. And then we'd come back to the meeting the next morning, right? I know that doesn't go on here in Decatur, Alabama. We're just really sick where I'm from. See, if y'all are new, you should start going out with people after the meeting, right? So, like, that's what we would do. And so, I was going to several meetings a day, and I got clean at this crazy meeting. People were throwing chairs at each other, and you slept with this newcomer. And people would tell me, you go to the 5:30 letting go group every day? If you go to that meeting, you're not going to stay clean. Well, guess what? I kept going to that meeting because I loved the drama. I wanted to see who slept with the newcomer. I wanted to see who stole the Seventh Tradition money, who was getting the check. Narcotics Anonymous has always been my favorite soap opera. And it kept me coming back. And now it was time for me to get a sponsor. And so I was going to this crazy meeting. And even though I loved the drama, I knew that those people who were throwing, I knew they shouldn't be my sponsor. That much I knew. And so I was looking around at who should be my sponsor, because I really had conceded to my innermost self that I was powerless over the disease of addiction. And so I'm sitting there, I'm looking around for the sponsor, right? And there was this woman in there, and her name was Michelle J. And she was like, my name is Michelle, and I'm an addict, and I got 2 years and 8 months clean. And every share, she would get in my favorite three words, right? Fuck, cock, and pussy. Every share, she would manage to fit in those three. And I was like, that's my sponsor, right? Because those were my qualifications for sponsorship, is that you'd be just as vulgar as I was, right? And so, like, I was like, all right. So I finally gathered the courage. You ever ask somebody to sponsor you? It's like asking somebody out on a date, right? So I went up, and I was like, hey, Michelle, will you sponsor me? And she looked at me, and she said, baby, I would love to sponsor you, but I can't. And I said, why not? She said, because, look, I believe that in Narcotics Anonymous, like, the men stick with the men and the women stick with the women. And I said, yeah, that don't apply to me because I'm gay. And she said, you can't be that anymore. I was like, what? She said, no, you can't be a gay addict anymore. I could, but I thought I was being a victim of some kind of fucking NA gay discrimination. Remember, this was the 90s, right? There was a bunch of homophobia. And it's coming back. It's making a comeback, though. And so... I was like, that's what I knew, right? I that's what I felt. I didn't know what she meant. And you know what I know today is that she was right. I have not been a gay addict since that day. Because the truth is, we have a 12th tradition that talks about anonymity being the spiritual foundation of all of our traditions. And what does that mean, right? That means that there is no such thing as a gay addict. There is no such thing as a straight addict, a black addict, a white addict, a rich addict, a poor addict, a Republican addict, a Democratic addict. There is no such thing. An addict is an addict. It must be an addict. Because what happens is if I look at myself as a gay addict and I look at myself as a black addict, I'm going to be sitting in a meeting and you can be sharing a life-saving message and I won't listen to you because you don't know my struggle because you're not black. You don't know my struggle because you're not gay. You don't know my struggle because you're not a teenager trying to get clean. An addict has to be just an addict, and that means I gotta do everything that everybody else is doing. And so if the men are getting man sponsors and the women are getting, and that's what I know today, but then I thought, yeah, fuck her. So I asked every other woman in the Southern Nevada area of Narcotics Anonymous to sponsor me, and none of you bitches would sponsor me, so I had to eventually end up getting this guy. Right? So remember, this is a crazy meeting. But amongst that craziness, there was this one guy who sat in the meeting, and I never heard him share, but he just kind of seemed to be at peace where everybody else was going crazy. And I asked him to sponsor me, and he told me he would if I was willing to work the 12 steps. He told me that's what sponsorship was about. It wasn't about me calling him every day, talking about the crazy things. He was not an audience for me to sit there and for him to sit there and listen to all the crazy things that went on and not seek any solution. If I was not willing, see, we read it at the beginning of every single meeting, but for some of us, it just doesn't sink in. All we care about is what you want to do about your problem and how we can help. If you don't want to do nothing, we can't help. So he said, I'll be willing to sponsor you if you're willing to work the 12 steps. And I said, he said, you're going to have to call me every day. And I was like, well, fuck, all right, I got to call him every day. But I was as desperate as only the dying can be, so I called him every day. And he told, he gave me a step, and I started writing on the first step. We didn't have a step working guide, so he asked me to write on some things. He said, I want you to write on obsession. And he said, you can find the definition of obsession in our basic text. And because that's what we did back then. We didn't have these things, so we actually had to have these things called, like, dictionaries and thesauruses. And y'all remember that shit? Yeah, we had to dig out all. It was a. You had to have some willingness to work them steps. Right? So I started working steps, and he's an obsession. That fixed idea that takes us back time and time again to one particular drug or some substitute.
Come on.
Or some substitute.
Talk about it.
That means there's some of us in here right now, clean for many years, that are locked in a fixed idea with some substitute to capture the ease and comfort we once knew. And he said, you gotta pick a few areas of your life that that applies to. Using drugs, relationships, sex, shopping. I picked all these things and he had me write about the obsession, and then he said, and write about compulsion, because those are the two things that make up true addiction, obsession and compulsion. Once we start the process with one fix, one pill, one drink, one text message, one drive by the house. So look, I'm going to tell you about this. See, I'm not just going to tell you about how this, how break down the steps as I know them. I'm going to tell you about how it applies to me in my life, right? See, this is what that sponsor did for me. The first step is what separates our fellowship from every other 12-step fellowship. Our first step doesn't talk about being powerless over alcohol, doesn't talk about being powerless over sex, doesn't talk about being powerless over gambling. It talks about being powerless over the disease of addiction. One disease, many different manifestations. So when I'm sitting in a meeting and I listen to someone share about a gambling addiction and a sex addiction, and believe me, it ain't just the newcomers that are sharing that stuff. It's some of us who have been around here for many years and operating off misinformation. addiction, right? When I'm sharing about a gambling addiction, a sex addiction, of this addiction, I believe that that is some of us who don't have a firm understanding of our first step, which tells us that there is one addiction with many different manifestations, right? So I'm writing about obsession and compulsion, and I can tell you about the way that applies to me and drugs, but I'm telling you about something else. So when I had about 2.5 years clean, I'm talking about this disease, obsession, compulsion, denial, total self-centeredness, right? And so I got about 2.5 years clean. First of all, I got into a relationship. I wrote about relationships in my first step. I got into a relationship when I had I had about 90 days clean, and I called my sponsor. I said, I'm thinking about getting into a relationship. He said, how serious are you thinking? I said, well, we're moving in together tomorrow as soon as I bail him out of jail. And it was always the jailbirds. It was always the jailbirds. You didn't have to just get out of jail. You had to look like you came from jail. Everybody that I dated had no job, no car. I was the only person that had anything. Like, that's what really got me going. The less you had, the more turned on I was. And you had to look the part too. You had to be like covered with tattoos. That's what everybody I dated, covered with tattoos. I remember I met this guy one time. He had all of these face tattoos. Like, you scared of me? And I said, hey, you should be scared of me. That's not what I'm attracted to anymore, but everybody that I dated, that's what they look like. What was that addict who read, who was that? Brian, they look like, bro, that's what every, Brian, you're too late. You're about 25 years too late. Sorry, the ship has sailed, right? And so, look, man, and so, I got into a relationship my first year clean, because that's what we want to do, right? We just want to, when we get clean, everybody thinks that a relationship will fix them. I thought it would fix me. I got into a relationship my first year clean, and I was obsessed with it. And we do the thing, you know, even if it was the perfect relationship, it was the same shit as it was an active addiction. We smacked each other around, we slept around on each other, because nothing had changed. There'd been no step work. There'd been no fourth step or fifth step to tell me who I was. There'd been no sixth step to take a look at my insecurities. There'd been no seventh step to allow me to be okay with who I was. None of that stuff had happened, right? And I was obsessed. And the truth is, like, even if he had been a good person, which he wasn't, because that's not what I liked, I was not thick. So I stayed obsessed with the relationships. And so on the topic of relationships, we have a book called The Living Clean, The Journey Continues. Great book, right? Before, all we had to tell us about relationships was the basic text. And it would say, and people would quote it all the times, relationship can be a... They would quote it like it was something fucking profound or something. Relationships can be a terribly painful thing. No shit, thanks. That's all you got for me? So for years, that's what we went around with in our literature, was relationships can be a terribly painful area. And wonder why we were also jacked up in the areas of relationships. But there's this book called The Living Clean Book, The Journey Continues. And it says in it, we all want a magic formula to make a relationship work. 1 year clean, 3 years clean, a fifth step, a round of fifth steps. And then it says, the truth is much easier and much harder to define. Hold your nose, because here comes the cold water. Because if you keep reading, what it says is, it says, there are those of us who will struggle our entire life and never be ready for a relationship. It says, we have seen members who are scholars in our principles with a string of failed marriages behind them. And a lot of people read that and they get so discouraged. But the truth is, I didn't get discouraged with many years reading that. I felt like I wasn't alone. Because the disease tells me that I'm so messed up sometimes. Look at this again. You cheated again. You got with somebody who cheated on you again. You're so fucked up. You're never going to. Everybody in recovery is getting this right except for you. Everybody in recovery just isn't talking about what's right. Like, trust me, you ain't the only one. So anyway, back to the first step. So we're talking about obsession and compulsion, right? Like, once we start the process with one fix, one pill, one drink, we can't stop of our own power of will. One text, one drive by the house to see if you're really there, because that's where the fuck you told me you're gonna be. So I got to go there to make sure your car and only your car is in there. So I had about 2.5 years clean, and I'm in another unhealthy situation. Guess what? We get an unhealthy situation. And this lasted almost a year. With a guy who was married to a woman. And that's what I was doing. And like, it was this secret, because at that time I still hadn't developed enough self-esteem to believe that I was better than to play second fiddle to somebody else. With multiple years clean. And so what I would do was his wife would be back in the picture, and then he would ice me out. And it wouldn't matter how he treated me then. Today, only if you talk to me tomorrow. See, some of us, the self-centeredness in relationships is about what can I get for you, and for some of us, it's about what do I have to give up to keep you in my life. And so I would do this thing, I'm talking about obsession and compulsion, that even when it hurts, I can't stop. I have a friend who says, oh, a compulsion is if it feels good, do it and do it over and over again. I'm telling you, compulsion for me is even if it doesn't feel good, keep doing it over and over and over again. I'm telling you, I got a disease that says you better not complain about the pain that you're feeling. You just better keep doing what you got to do to not feel whatever it is you don't want to feel, no matter how bad it hurts, no matter how bad it's lowering your self-esteem. So I got 2.5 years clean, and I'm in a relationship with somebody who puts me second and third, somebody who will have sex with me and then won't answer the phone for the next 2 weeks and then come up and love bomb me. That's a word for it now, love bomb me. We didn't have that word back then, but that's the word. And then come back and love bomb me, right? And so I'm in this relationship and I can't stop. See, sometimes we get clean and we start writing on the steps and we know what obsession and compulsion is. But the truth is, you never really get to see what obsession and compulsion is until you're living in it clean. Because I'm telling you, when he wouldn't answer my phone, we didn't, like I said, we didn't have a bunch of these back then. So I would call him and I would block my number. What's that thing that you used to
have?
I knew what it's called. I just want to see if there's any more stalkers about. Fucking sick bitch stalker. You're some stalkers, right? My people. So I would dial *67. I'd dial *67 and he'd answer the phone and I'd be like, hey, it's me. Then he'd hang up on me. So then I'd go to the bank and I'd call from the bank and he'd be like, hello. I'd be like, hey, it's me again. I just love it. And then I'd go to the grocery store and I'd be like, hey. And then I went and I shared this in a meeting what I was doing, and somebody said, you know, Charles, there's laws against what you're doing. And so what would happen was I would catch the bus from one side of the 2-hour bus ride to sit in the bushes. Now I got 3 years clean and I'm literally sitting in the bushes watching someone, right? See, it talks about it in our third step. Because there was a bunch of euphoria wrapped up in the relationship at one point. And that's okay. If you ain't been in a relationship like that clean, this message ain't for you, but it's for somebody, because I know I ain't the only one, right? So I had 3.5 years clean and I'm hiding in the bushes, and here's what it talks about in our third step. You know what the line it says? It says, after a while, the euphoria began to wear off and we began to see the ugly side of addiction. You ever seen the ugly side of addiction clean? I'm talking about, I had 3 years clean and I'm stalking somebody who doesn't even want me. Doesn't even want me. Right? I'm talking about obsession and compulsion. And then this man guided me to the second step. And I came to believe that Narcotics Anonymous could restore me to sanity in all areas if I just trusted the process. And what's the process? The rest of the steps. Sponsorship. I came to believe that. I was still insane when I finished the second step, but the difference was I had a belief. I believed, after that second step, I believed in Narcotics Anonymous the way a child believes in Santa Claus. I came to believe. And then I went on to the third step and decided that this power greater than myself could be anything that I wanted it to be. And so the third step for me isn't just about, do you believe in God? Sometimes the longer that we stay around here, it's about, do you just believe in God or do you believe God? That's faith. Do you? And if you don't call it God, do you believe that you're going to be taken care of no matter what? Because if I truly believe I'm going to be taken care of no matter what by this power, if I truly believe I'm in the care of, then what's going to happen is I'm not going to live in self-will. I don't need to, because I'm in the care of. Everything's already taken care. There's a plan that's working for me. All I gotta do is take the next indicated step. I'm talking about a transformation process happens when we work these steps. That's what seems to start happening. And then I went on to the fourth step, right? And in this process, I'm developing a relationship with a man. And that third step, we got down on our knees and we prayed. And I experienced an intimacy I'd never experienced, and I was so grateful that none of those women agreed to sponsor me. Because if they had have, they would have been robbing me of the opportunity to develop the most intimate relationship I would ever develop with another man, was through sponsorship. And so I went on and I started working this fourth step. And the question is why? Like, why did I use drugs for so long, even when it was destroying my life? Why was I taking the bus across town fucking stalking people? Because, by the way, that guy wasn't the only person I stalked. Right? So I'm like, but why was I doing that? Like, why? Like, why didn't I have enough self-worth and self-esteem? And so I began to write. And I began to write about a mother. A mother who was married 5 times with boyfriends and fiancés in between there. A mother who loved me more than life itself, but that message didn't always come through. I began to see that feeling like I was second fiddle was nothing new to me. I began to see that I had a mother that was in abusive relationships, and I always felt second. I began to write about being abused by her second husband. See, there's some this isn't all in just one fourth step. I believe that no matter how long we stay here, we never stop changing, we never stop growing, and the step working process never ceases. So I continue to work the steps, and I've done several. And in those fourth steps, I began to write about a little boy whose mother walked in on him being abused physically. Like her second husband would put a bullet in a gun and then play Russian roulette and say, anytime a bullet could come out and I'll shoot it in and I'll kill you, you'll be dead, right? And after she walked in on that, she left him. And 6 months later, she turned around and she said, how would you feel? Would it be okay with you if I went back to Bobby? See, this is what I'm writing about. This is what I was writing about in the fourth step. And she never went back to him. But what I learned in the fourth step was I got a message then. A couple messages. Number one, you're not a first priority. Number two, this is the person that's supposed to protect you. This is the person that loves you more than anybody else in the world. And it is not enough, so you only have yourself to depend on. I'm talking about, in the fourth step, I begin to see where a belief system is formed. And then I write about a father. A father who was like in active addiction, but I didn't know that he was in active addiction. He would always say that he was going to come pick me up at noon, and noon would turn to 2, and 2 would turn to 5, and 5 would turn to 8, and my mother would have to drag me back in the house screaming, and I would say, it's all your fault. I know he came, but he just drove by the house because I wasn't there, and I knew on the inside he never drove by the house. I knew on the inside that I was not important enough for him to show up. My dad and I, and my dad has been more. See, you always blame the parent that's there, right? Because my mom was always there. She wasn't perfect, but she was there, and it was so easy to blame her. My dad was never there, so my sponsor would always ask me over the years with fifth steps, "What about your dad?" He didn't have much of an impact on me because he wasn't really there a lot. Right? That didn't him. He's like, not having a dad never impacts you? Nah, not really. It's all my mom's fault. It's all her fault. How dare she be there? So. I'm talking about, so I was writing in the last fourth step I wrote about this dad that I had, right? And so my dad, my mom would send me over to my dad's house, And we'd spend the first night together, and that first night we'd always do the same thing. There's this old show called The Carol Burnett Show, if anybody remembers it, right? We'd watch The Carol Burnett Show, okay? And we'd watch The Carol Burnett Show together, and at the end she sings this song, and we'd always sing it together. I'm so glad we had this time together, just to laugh or sing a song. Seems we just got started, and before you know it, comes time for you to say it so long. And my dad and I would sing that song together, right? And so the next morning, I would wake up every time. Every summer I'd wake up and my dad would be packing his stuff to go. And I'd be like, Dad, are you leaving? And he'd be like, oh, I'm getting ready to go see a friend about something. And I'd say, okay, goodbye. And he'd say, we don't say goodbye, son. And I'd say, what do we say, Dad? And together we'd sing it. I'm so glad we had this time together, just to laugh or sing a song. Seems we just got started, and before you know it, comes time we have to say so long. And when I would sing my dad, that song of my dad, I'd know two things. Number one, I'd know he loved me. And number two, I knew that I wasn't going to see him anymore. Right? And he'd be gone on a run for however long. Right? And I'm telling you all this because this is stuff that's come up in the past 5 years. I've been clean 26 years. This is stuff that's coming. I'm talking about a continual process. And so I'm like going through this fourth step, and more about my dad comes up. When I was 4 years old, my dad would come. He came to my mom's house, and I woke up, and they were together, and they talked about how we were going to be together, and we were going to be a family. And we went and looked at schools, and we went and got ice cream, and we came back to the house, and they wanted to put me down for a nap. And I remember not wanting to take a nap, thinking that my dad wasn't going to be there, and they assured me that he was. And I would wake up, and my dad wasn't there when I woke up. And my mother was crying, and we went out and we looked for my dad, right? So we go out, we look for him, and we find him. And he's in a car with another woman and her children. And my mother is standing out there screaming, get out of the car and explain to your son why. And my dad wouldn't get out of the car. And the woman drove off with my mother holding onto the side view mirror, dragging her. And I began to watch my dad drive off with another woman and her children. What I'm talking about is a belief system and where this comes from and why we do the things that we do with years clean. And if we do not take a look at ourselves in the step working process, we will continue to do these things with many years clean. Yes. And so, like, I list all that stuff down and I share it with a sponsor. And one of the most powerful experiences that I had was in the fifth step. See, I've always been able to listen to your story and cry my eyes out. But I can stand up here and I can talk to you about an abused and neglected and abandoned little boy that I was, and it won't affect me at all. I can connect to you and feel empathy for you, but I can't connect to me sometimes. And one of the most intimate experiences I had with the fifth step, I had about 10 or 12 years clean. And I was reading this step like nothing ever happened. And then, yeah, I got abused. And the guy used to put a gun to my head and pull the trigger and da-da-da-da-da. And then, okay, now we go on to the sixth step. And I was like, hold on. Hold the fuck on. And I said, well, he goes, let me see your fifth step. And I said, oh, now I don't know about you. If you sit down going, I got 26 years clean today. And if my sponsor wants to look at my step, I'm still like, oh, hold on. It's mine. Right? And so this guy, like, grabs my fourth step. And he says, I just want you to sit back, shut up, and listen. And he begins to read. He begins to read about a little boy. A little boy waiting all night for his dad that never showed up. A little boy that listened to his mother get beaten and raped. A little boy who was abused by a man. A little boy who grew up and took that hurt out on other people his entire life. A little boy with many years clean who was continuing to hurt himself because of unresolved experiences. And as I listened to him share about that little boy, I began to cry. And for the first time, I began to connect with my own story. I began to connect. That's how powerful our steps are, right? For the first time, I connected with myself. I began to see why I was in relationships with people who didn't have a car. Because I was afraid one day they might drive off and leave me just the way my dad drove off and left me with that other woman. I began to see why I was always in relationships with somebody who didn't have a job, who didn't have any money, because I couldn't be in a relationship with someone who wanted to be with me. I had to be in a relationship with someone who needed to be with me. Because if you didn't need me, you wouldn't stay. So I'm going to, look, talking about the fifth step, I got a friend, right? I've had issues, right? I've had issues with men who beat their women. Because my mother was constantly beat when I was growing up. Right? And we bring that shit into recovery, and guess what? It prevents us from helping the addict who still suffers. Right? And we think it's okay. Yeah, fuck women beaters. We don't have to help those addicts. Wait a minute. Fuck pedophiles. We don't have to help those addicts. But we do. So a sponsor in this guy, there's no connection, really. I know there's stuff that he's keeping from me. There's no connection, and he always disappears. Well, his girlfriend calls me, and he says, look, you need to know why Ken's disappearing. He's disappearing because he's always in jail. He's always in jail for beating my ass. And all of a sudden, I put a wall up for Ken. And Ken's never talking to me about this. So I call my sponsor, and I'm like, I got this guy who I'm going to let him go. My sponsor's like, you're going to do what? I said, I'm going to let him go. Why? He's beating his girl. And he's beating his girl, so I'm going to let him go. What are you talking about? My sponsor says. He goes, you got a steal sponsor? I said, well, I got issues because my mother was beat. I got issues. I can't sponsor people who beat their women. He goes, oh, so he doesn't get to be sponsored because you haven't done the work.
Help somebody.
So I started doing the work. And then I said, okay, I'm willing to sponsor. And I started sponsoring him. And I said, I know you're going to jail. Because I know where you disappeared to. You might as well talk to me about it. And so I started. So I called my sponsor. I said, well, I'm sponsoring him through it now. And you know what my sponsor said? He said, that's not enough. The truth is, it was not enough for me to sponsor him through abusing, sponsor this tortured, hurt man. Because beating his girlfriend was hurting him more than it was hurting me. It wasn't enough for me to sponsor him through it. I had to learn to love him through it. And something happened on the inside of me. God puts the people in our lives who are supposed to be there. And if there is a lesson that we're supposed to learn and we keep getting rid of those people, the same people will keep coming in our lives over and over and over again. And I learned to love him through it. And I began to forgive my father. And I began to forgive the other men who beat my mother. And then just recently, like one of my best friends, right? Past year or two, has been in this awful relationship. Fucking abusive. I mean everything, because she's had black eyes. And she's in recovery too. And he's in recovery. And she's got black eyes. And she's got... And when I'm talking about the disease, I'm talking about the defect of codependency in me. Right? So she's got black eyes. Oh, he gave me... I didn't want to tell you this, but he gave me a black eye. She's got a knot on her head. I didn't want to tell you this. She FaceTimes me, and she only FaceTimes me so I can see half of her fucking face, right? Well, that's because the other side of her face has a knot on it, right? And oh, he cuts me. He stabbed me. I get, like, all this shit is going on. And so now I'm showing up for her, and she says, I want to be done. So she wants to be done, so now I'm willing to show up for her, right? But here's the thing about the defect of codependency. Codependency, doesn't it sound like you're a victim when you're living in the defect? I just like to be there for people, and they take advantage of me. Here's the thing about codependency. Showing up for someone is being there for someone, but when I'm codependent, I'm attached to the outcome, and I am there for you as long as the outcome, what you're doing, results in what I want you to do. But as soon as you don't do what I want you to do, watch out. And so I get a text from her, and she says, look, I'm gonna go back to him. We've been doing counseling, and I didn't want to tell you because I am afraid that you will distance yourself from me. And everything, and so I'm talking about issues with my dad. Here goes my issues with my mother. Everything inside of me wanted to text back, I am gonna distance myself from you. And how dare you do this to me? Now it's about me. I'm talking about unresolved experiences. didn't say that. You know what I said? I said, I called her. I prayed before I called her. I talked to my sponsor. I invited a loving God into the situation. And I said, if you want to leave him or if you want to be with him, I'm here for it. I'm here for you no matter what. And instead of being codependent and controlling, I got to show up. And that's what I'm there for, is no matter what. And those wounds started to heal. Right? So, look. We're talking about unresolved experiences, and I could be up here forever, but I don't have forever to be up here. Right? So, I'm going to tell you a couple more things, and then I'm going to sit my ass down. Look. There's a certain expectation here. What I want to tell you, man, is the person that you've been looking up, that you're looking, see, social acceptability doesn't equal recovery. Like, yeah, I know, you're clapping, but I'm talking about social acceptability inside the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous does not equal recovery. I'm talking about sponsoring a bunch of people does not equal recovery. I'm talking about being up here at a podium for many years, many times, does not equal recovery. I'm talking about if you got shit that you're not working on, it's going to show up. And for many years, I had lust issues. I had sex issues that were not being addressed that I wasn't talking about. And if you don't want to address your issues, that's okay. Don't address them. But this is what's going to happen. So, I had all this, like, you know, I was cut off from the sharing process with relationships because I've been hurt so many times because everybody I slept with was either married or was using me. So I decided I don't want to do that. Around that time, the age of the internet came along, right? And so I would get on the internet. And the good thing about the internet is you can be anyone you want at any time. So I decided I'm not going to be Charles on the internet. I'm going to be like some Latina chick with big tits. And so we think we're inventing something. I thought I was inventing something here. I didn't know there was a whole fucking show like named after the shit I was doing. I thought I was like creating some shit. So I would like be doing, and then before you know it, I start doing it with people in the program, right? So I start tricking them, right? And they said they're sending me naked pictures of them. I'm sending them naked pictures of God knows who, right? And so like I'm talking to my sponsor about this because at this point I had years clean. Years clean. I'm sharing at several conventions a year. I'm sponsoring half my local fellowship, and nobody knows except for my sponsor, because that's the one thing I've always done right, is I've always told my sponsor everything. And my sponsor's like, all right, you're gonna get busted. And I'd be like, hee-hee-hee, oh yeah, buddy. He's like, all right, because I'm waiting for the phone call, right? And so I'm doing this, and one day I open social media, and there's an email. And the email says, there is a predator in our midst. And I was like, ooh, somebody's busted. So I keep reading them. They're like, and he has many years clean, and he speaks all over the country, and he sponsors all different kinds. I was like, ooh, they call him Big Fish. They said, and what he does is he goes around and he preys on women, on men in our fellowship, pretending to be women, and he pretends to be some of us, and he sends, and I was like, oh my God! And his name is Charles Baber III. Look, there's an old saying, you can do anything you want to as long as you're willing to pay the consequences. You're not. Stop saying that. It's a stupid saying. I'm not willing to pay the consequences. Neither are you. We are never willing to pay the consequences for anything. I'm never willing. And what were my consequences? My consequences were after that day, I sponsored the same 16 men for 10 years. After that day, I never heard from 13 of them ever again. My consequences was I would walk into meetings and people would not hug me. My consequences were people would tell me, you may as well go kill yourself because no one wants you here. Those are my consequences. You can do whatever you want, but you don't get to choose what the consequences are. And you don't get to choose how long this, because this went on for years. I'm talking about walking into meetings in my area where no one would speak to me, and not 2 years, 5, 6, 7 years this went on for. That's how long this was going on for. Years. I'm going into meetings and no, these were my consequences. I was a joke in my area and in my region. I was of service. People came to region and asked for me to step down from my regional position. So what are you gonna do, man, when you've been sharing all this good, when you're a good sharing ass? What are you gonna do? I wanted to run away. It says in our 10th step, we can back ourselves into a corner we can't make it out of clean. I had 15 years clean, and I was sitting in my I was sitting in my apartment, and my options I felt were to get loaded or commit suicide because of my own behavior. Not blame, can't blame it on anybody else. So what I did was I continued to go to the meetings, the same meetings where people wouldn't speak to me. I continued to go to. Same meetings where people asked me not to go to. And then, you know what I did? I didn't say, you guys are all blaming me. You guys are... I had to share, and I had to say, I fucked up. And I had to keep sharing that for years. I had to take responsibility. And I showed up and I did it for years, even when it seemed like it wasn't working and I was never going to be accepted in my area, in my region, in Narcotics Anonymous. And this is what I can share with you, is that that same region that said I was too sick to be of... And by the way, if we're kicking people out of service for acting out sexually, we'll have no more trusted servants. Look, I just want to put that out there. Right. So that same region that kicked me out of service... 10 years later, voted me in the position that I am now to represent as their region as the regional delegate at the World Service Conference of Narcotics Anonymous. So this is what I'm sharing with you, is that no matter what you're going through, if you've been busted out, if nobody wants to talk about you, like if nobody wants to talk to you, all they want to do is talk about you, just keep showing up and keep taking responsibility. And there is someone who has your back. I know it looks like there isn't, but I promise you that there is. There is. Right? So the last thing that I'm going to share with you, because I've been sharing about unresolved issues, right, is that dad. So the relationship throughout recovery was off and on, and so I start developing a relationship with my dad again, because I decided it's not about what kind of a father he was to me. It's about what kind of a son I could be to him. That's the gift that I got from the eighth step and from the ninth step. It will not make us better people to look at the faults of another. Right? So I start practicing this amends to my dad. And so I go on and I'm like, all right, dad, I'm going to be there for you no matter what. And we start building a relationship. I start calling him, and then after a while he starts calling me. And I get, one of the things that I wanted to happen was I wanted to join the Army. And so when I had about 13 years clean, I joined the Army. And so I wanted to be in the Army. I go there, I join the Army, and then once I join the Army, I see that I watch this commercial, this guy, like he's an E6, he's a staff sergeant, and I was like, well, I'm in the Army, but I'm never gonna make it up that high. Well, here's the thing, is today I'm still in the Army, and I'm not an E6, I'm not a staff sergeant, I'm an E8, I'm a master sergeant of the United States Army. When the drugs go and the addict works a program, wonderful things happen. Lost dreams awaken, new possibilities arise. We're a vision of hope. So I join the Army, right, and I'm developing this relationship with my dad, and I get deployed to Iraq, and now these things are a thing, so my dad and I are FaceTiming, and before you know it, we're FaceTiming every day. And now I got a relationship with my dad. It's not as close as it could be, but it's a relationship, and we're tight. And he tells me one day, he says, Charles, I have cancer. And I said, we're going to fight this thing together. I didn't know anything about cancer. I said, what kind of cancer? He said, it's pancreatic. And I said, that's okay. We're going to get through this. My deployment ends. I live in Las Vegas. He lives in LA. I drive every Monday from Las Vegas to LA to take him 4 hours, to take him on a Monday, to take him to chemotherapy on a Tuesday, and then go to a meeting that night in Los Angeles, share about how horrible, because if you've ever watched anyone go through chemotherapy, it is a horrible process to go through. And I start watching my dad, but some things happen in that process, in that horrible process. Right? They told me that my dad was not going to live. But I believed in the power of prayer and I kept praying. And in that process of taking my dad to chemotherapy, I said, Dad, what happened? He said, when? I said, all those times you said you were going to come and you never went. You know what that did to me? You know what my dad said? He said, I can't tell you what happened. What I can tell you is that I was on drugs for a lot of years. And what I can tell you is that I failed as a father, and every time I looked at you, it reminded me of my failure as a father. And it was easier just not to look. But what I want you to know is that it had everything to do with me and nothing to do with you. You are perfect. What happened was my father healed me at that point. And now I knew, like, I couldn't go on. Like, I couldn't lose him. I believed in the power of prayer. So when those doctors told me he wasn't going to die, I knew that he was going to die. I knew he wasn't, because I believed in the power of prayer, and I kept praying for healing. And the more I prayed for healing, the sicker my father became. And the sicker my father became, the angrier I got with God. And I moved my father out to Vegas with me. He got off the plane. The next day I took him to the hospital because he was lethargic. And turns out he was just taking too much of his medication, because when when the cancer gets too rough, that's what they do, is they take a lot of medication because the pain is unbearable. And after a while, my dad didn't speak anymore. I sat in the hospital and I watched him just lay there for a week or two. Incoherent, but I sat there every day, praying, being resentful at God. And then I had to go see my sponsor, who lived in Pittsburgh, and so I was going to leave my dad's side for the weekend. Even though I knew he wasn't going to respond, I whispered in his ear, I said, "Hey, Dad, I'm leaving. I'll be back, though. I'm only going for the weekend." And my dad, who hadn't spoke to me in weeks, who they told me was going to die, opened his eyes and looked at me. And he said, "No." And I said, "No, I won't go." He goes, "No, go, but no goodbye." And I said, "All right, Dad, what are we going to say?" And my dad, who hadn't spoken to me in weeks, who hadn't been able to speak, as clear as I'm talking to you, looked at me and said, "I'm so glad we had this time together. You made me feel like I belong. It seems we just got started, and before you know it, comes time I have to say so long." And he smiled and he closed his eyes and he went back to sleep. And I knew two things. I knew that my father loved me, and I knew I was never going to get to hear him sing again. And I went to Pittsburgh, and my sponsor poured into me, and my sponsee brothers poured into me. Then I flew back to Las Vegas. They brought my dad to my house on a Tuesday, and then on Wednesday, August 1st, my mom was holding one hand and my dad, and I was holding the other, and the hospice nurse said, "He doesn't have a heartbeat, he's gone." And what I realized when I saw my mom, who had been divorced from my dad for 36 years after he beat her within an inch of his life, was holding his hand when he died, and I was holding the other hand, I realized I had been resentful at God for no reason. I was praying for healing and thinking that healing didn't happen, but healing was happening. Just not the way that I thought it was. So I share that with you to share. If you're praying for something and it doesn't believe like God is showing up, you may be looking for God to be coming from the left, but he's really coming from the right. But no matter what direction, God is going to show up. He's showing up. So, with that, what I want to say to you is, I'm so glad we had this time together. You made me feel like I belong. Seems like I just got started, and before you know it, comes time I have to say so long.
You know, I'm pretty out of your way.